There has to be some common sense.
Yes, sir. They have the car stopped at 10th and Grant's bike rider.
We still don't know who pulled the trigger. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Police Off the Cuff, Real Crime Stories. I'm your host, retired NYPD Sergeant Bill Cannon, a 27-year veteran of the NYPD. A lot of different things happening in regards to the Idaho quadruple case. Of course, Ethan Chapin, Zaina Knodel, Madison Mogan, and Kaylee Gonsalves. And a lot of it has to do with hearings relative to the gag order. I think those hearings started today, and they will also run tomorrow. And it's sort of been let out that the defense does not want cameras in the courtroom. And that's all part of this gag order. And I think what a judge has to weigh is the need for the public and the press to know versus the rights of the accused, in this case, Brian Koberger, to get a fair and impartial trial. At this point, I think it will be very, very difficult for them to get jurors that who have never heard anything about this case. It's been all over the media, not just nationally, internationally, since it occurred on the morning of November 13th. So how would a judge weigh this in his decisions? I believe the attorney for the Gonsalveses, he's arguing that the gag order should be lifted and they should be allowed to talk about it and they should be privy to the inside information of the investigation. However, again, the overriding issue that a judge has to decide is the fairness to the defendant, and will lifting the gag order cause this rumor and innuendo to basically go off the charts like it did prior to the gag order being instituted. We see even now certain stations have, you know, sources close to the investigation, which is, the station can do that, but who is ever pumping them with information, whether it's true or false information, it's really not fair. It's not fair to the case. It's not fair to others that don't have this source close to the investigation who's supposed to be silenced via a gag order. So when we hear all this stuff, and then we also have to question how accurate is the information that some of these stations are getting from a source close to the investigation. How accurate is it? Those are some of the questions that the judge has to decide upon. The other thing is that the case is slated to begin on October 2nd. Now, that date, it may or may not be the beginning of the trial. The case, the defense could request a stay and say they're not ready. And in that case, the judge, because this is a death penalty case, I think the judge will bend over backwards to appease the defense. The prosecution, by law, has to answer ready, and they have to show up ready when they're required to answer. The defense is a little bit different. And again, because this is a death penalty case, the judge in this case, and it was Judge John Judge. He was a born judge, I guess, with that last name. So we're hearing more and more information, but there will be another hearing tomorrow, and hopefully we'll hear a decision based on this. Cameras in the courtroom is a double-edged sword. First of all, cameras in the courtroom can never, ever show the jury. That would endanger the jury. It would make the jury a little bit afraid of making the correct decision because their face and their name would be out into the public. So if there are cameras in the courtroom, it'll focus on certain things, the prosecutor, the defense, the defendant, and perhaps, of course, some of the witnesses that go up onto the stand, but never can they ever show the jury. Now, I don't know what your feelings are, you folks listening to this, but my reference has always been, of course, the trial of the century, which was the O.J. Simpson case. And I always felt that the cameras made it sort of an unnatural courtroom. And by that, I mean, is that prosecutors, defense, and witnesses alike played to the cameras. They knew they were on camera. They knew the whole world was watching. And it was almost like a movie or a play going on. And I think the cameras have the effect of, again, creating almost an artificial environment. Even the judge in the O.J. Simpson case, it was a Judge Ito. There was some testimony that one of the detectives had disparaged his wife, who was a captain on the LAPD. And he visibly got upset and acted out on, like, putting his head in his hands. And I was just like, how inappropriate was that? And it was that just for the cameras, or would he do that on a regular basis if there was no cameras in the courtroom? I'm not meaning to beat on Judge Ito, but many other times the prosecutors, Marcia Clark, she absolutely played to the cameras. The defense, Johnny Cochran, F. Lee Bailey, Robert Shapiro, all these, Barry Scheck, all of these high profile and high dollar attorneys, cameras in the courtroom, they couldn't love it more, because that gives them the exposure that they need for their next huge case. So are cameras in the courtroom, is it helping the defendant? How about the community? Does the community of Moscow, Idaho, Latah County, do you think they want cameras in the courtroom? I don't know. I don't really know the answer to that. Possibly, because, again, there's limited seats in a courtroom. People will be there almost every day, or that will be there every day at the start of the trial to see what's going on. Let's see what some of the professionals in the media say about this. And I'm going to play a little bit of this. And then we're eventually going to get to... there's no less than two authors at this time. James Patterson, famous, best-selling author, and another author named Howard Bloom, who was a 2 times Pulitzer Prize nominated author who used to write for the New York Times and Vanity Fair, and he now writes for a magazine called Airmail. Both of these individuals are writing a book on the Idaho murders of Ethan Chapin, Zahina Knodel, Madison Mogan, and Kaylee Gonsalves. Now, what if they finish the book before the case is over? Are they going to wait till the trial is over? Because they've already started writing their books. I believe Howard Bloom has put out 4 excerpts on the magazine Airmail already, of which will inevitably become the first 4 chapters, inevitably. I can't even talk. Be the first 4 chapters of his book. So how does that prejudice would-be jurors, or does it? And again, we all root for freedom of speech, freedom of the press. And I'm not saying they at all should be silenced, but is this ethically, is it ethically the time to write a book about a murder that has shut down a university town, that has so affected 4 families that they'll never, ever be the same? I'm playing devil's advocate. I'm asking you guys these questions. And I hope that you think long and hard about it. What are your feelings? Does freedom of speech, freedom of the press, trump a fair and impartial trial? Does it trump the rights of people's right to know? That's some of the questions we have to ask.
still with us. Jack, to you first on this idea that the defense doesn't want cameras, the prosecution is sort of iffy, saying at the end of the day it's up to the court, but they also, they seems like they're not big fans of it. From the victim family member's point of view, bring it on. They want people to see what this person allegedly did. Why is it, do you think, and we went through this with the Lori Vallow scenario, and they ended up banning cameras. What's the problem? Why? What's the mentality, do you think, of the players involved, prosecutors and sometimes judges and defense attorneys that, no cameras, you know, what do you think is behind that? I know what they argue, but what do you really think is going on?
What they're afraid of, and let's stay with the defense for a second. The reason the defense is afraid of cameras in this case is because what they really want is they're trying to find, and the terms they're usually going to use is a fair and impartial jury. And the fear is that if all of this evidence and all these little pieces come rolling out, what it's going to do is it's going to convince everybody in the room before the doors even open that that guy did it. And what they're hoping for is to get somebody who can sit back and say, okay, let's look at all the evidence as it's presented in the courtroom. Because I can tell you the difference between what we see in the world and what actually gets to the jury itself is sometimes very different. And they're struggling in this case because there is a lot of evidence. And there's a lot that could come in everywhere from Washington to Idaho to scrubbing across the country all the way to Pennsylvania and everything in between. And if all of those pieces come together, including triangulation and where the cars are and where the eyewitnesses are and the DNA and the knife and everything else, or the knife sheath anyway, all of that is going to make it almost impossible to get one of those jurors or 12 of those jurors to come in and say, yeah, I'll wait and see what gets presented. That's really their argument.
And Josh, in their motion, the defense pointed out that every time he's in court and there's video of it, the media or people online, they're calling him a creep or look at his eyes or he's dead behind those eyes. And sometimes there's body language experts analyzing, well, yeah, he looks like he's blank. He looks like he's blank. Do they have a point that because there is so much interest here that there could be some damage to his rights?
Absolutely. The integrity of the system is the ostensible issue at hand. And the state, the defense, and the court have a public obligation to ensure the integrity of our criminal justice system. But at the same time, despite their best intentions, they're showing everybody that the criminal justice system isn't an experiment in openness and transparency. It's an exercise in secrecy. It's an exercise in keeping information away from people, only giving certain information at certain times in a regulated manner in order to produce what is ostensibly and hopefully a fair result. And there are big problems with overexposing certain issues in the criminal justice system, especially.
You know, folks, this attorney is right on. He's really explaining this very well. But the other part of it that didn't used to be an issue, of course, is social media. And everyone online, everyone on YouTube, everyone on Instagram, everyone on Facebook, everyone on Snapchat is an expert on this case. People claim to know more than the next person. And these are people that never carried a gun and never, you know, chased down a criminal in their life, but they're geniuses when it comes to this case. And think of all the prejudice toward this case, not just due to the media and due to the horrific nature of this crime, but due to social media, which has a bigger stretch than broadcast media.
Victims, things like that. What we're seeing going on in the Peterson case, for example, where someone might have wanted some secrecy or privacy or confidentiality. The people in a case such as Koberger, they don't get any of that. And everybody's talking about how much more victimization is going to happen to the families of these murder victims during this trial. So there's really very valid justifications to not overexpose it. that's balanced, though, with the natural interest of everybody else in the country wanting to know how our criminal justice system works, wanting to ensure the integrity of our courts, of our police, of the defense. We have a natural interest in that. And it's really important that we know what's going on. And hopefully the courts are going to regulate this appropriately. I feel with the public issues at hand, we need more transparency in this case, even if it makes it more difficult for the state to successfully chase a death penalty.
Yeah, and you do have the jury selection process, which hopefully can eliminate some of the issues that are.
So, folks, that attorney raised some great issues about the criminal justice system isn't required for the public to be transparent. He said, and he's correct in what he said, that parts of the criminal justice system are done in secret and for good reason, to protect witnesses, right? The grand jury, the indictment by that grand jury, which so many people online, so many people that have been following this case freaked out. Oh, that's not fair to Brian Koberger. These people don't know what they're talking about. The grand jury system is used all across this country. And sometimes it's strategic. And in this case, the prosecutor, of course, didn't want to go to all of these probable cause hearings. So in secret, again, in secret, he opened up a grand jury and presented evidence to the grand jury. The witnesses testifying before the grand jury, secretive. Imagine that was put out into the public. Oh, such and such witness testified and said this. Our system could collapse if that was in fact the case, if they were revealing the identities of witnesses to a grand jury. And that is why the grand jury is a secret body. And it's so, so very important that it remains that way. And, you know, cameras in the courtroom and gag orders released, all of those things. Everyone wants to know what's going on with this case. Everyone, you know, myself included. But I understand the criminal justice system, and certain things have to be kept secretive for the integrity of this case. I don't know if I'm beating a dead horse, but that's the reason. And, you know, as I said, I'm going to cover this now. At least two authors, one very famous author, is writing a book right now as this case is going on. What will that do to the case? How does that affect the case? How does that affect the jury pool? How does that affect the family? How does that affect the criminal justice system? How does it affect a famous author like this, like a James Patterson? Again, information close to the investigation. Will some be leaking information to him? He's a multimillionaire author whose books have sold millions and millions of copies. Might he get information that no one else was privy to because of who he is? Let's take a look at this.
News Nation, particularly our Brian Enten, has led the way on reporting since the beginning.
We requested information from Prosecutor Bill Thompson's office about his history with death penalty cases, but we were told that request was denied because of the Brian Koberger gag order. We have confirmed that Brian Koberger's parents were called to testify in front of this investigative grand jury.
All right, James Patterson will detail the killings of four University of Idaho students found murdered in their off-campus housing. The book will come out before the trial of suspected killer Brian Koberger, and James Patterson joins us now, America's best-selling author in history.
Yeah, I don't know that the book is going to come out before the trial, but we're working on it right now. Vicki Ward and I, who's a very, very good journalist.
What about this case? Why this Idaho case is so fascinating?
I think the secret to great mystery stories is questions that the viewer or the reader must have answered. And that's what this has. I mean, we think Brian Koberger is guilty. We'll see when the trial happens in late September. But there's still big questions. Why did he murder these young people? What is the effect on the town, on the families? He wanted to create, seemed to want to create the perfect murder. He didn't. What went wrong? And what happened beforehand when he was in Pennsylvania? Were there things that happened? Did he create, you know, did he commit any great crimes before he went out to Idaho? So there's a lot of questions, and that's what drove me to write the book.
You're famous, obviously, for detective novels, for the Alex Cross novels. And what I'm wondering is there something about writing truth that allows it to be stranger than fiction, that you can do things with truth that are because what? Fiction has to make sense. Truth doesn't.
Well, hopefully the fiction makes some sense, that it tracks okay. You know, I do have an Alex Cross book coming out right now. It just came out today, Cross Down. It's the first Cross book that's ever come out in the summer. And Samson, his partner, is the big storyteller in this. And once again, getting back to what I said about the Idaho murders, questions that as readers and as viewers that we must get answered. The question here, the title is Cross Down, does Alice Cross survive? That's the big question throughout the book. And I think why a lot of people are going to go and order the book very quickly and read it very quickly. But that goes right back to Idaho in terms of those questions we must have answered.
Yeah, no, my mom is a huge fan of Alex Cross and obviously of your writing. So I think that she will be already has ordered it off of Amazon. Help me understand.
I like your mom, and I like you better because of your mom.
Well, thank you. Most people feel that way. Then you meet the dog and you like everybody. Help us understand real quick about Koberger. The Idaho formers, there was something about the murder of four college students, right? There's tragedies that happen. There's murders that happen all the time.
Yeah.
What about this, you think? And you've had a unique ability to understand what pulls at America.
You're looking at it.
Yeah.
You're looking at it. Here are these four victims, these terrific kids, the families, wonderful families that have been, you know, decimated. A town. This is a little similarity to Truman Capote wrote a very famous book in Cold Blood, where a terrible two killers come to a small town. And it's a terrible thing that happened. Same thing happened, and this is Moscow, Idaho, where, you know, a wonderful college town, good kids, and all of a sudden this terrible thing happens. And the town isn't really ready for it. You know, they haven't had things like this. They don't have murders out there like this.
Yeah.
The detectives have not dealt with stuff like this before. The prosecutor hasn't.
And one last question. I only got a couple of seconds, but I wanted to get it in. You guys have done a lot of your own reporting on this. Is there anything you've uncovered so far that's not in the public record?
Yeah, but we're not telling it tonight. tonight we're going to sell it. Tonight we're going to tell people to go read the new Alex Cross book because it's really
all
fun.
Right. All right. Well, you've left us in suspense, sir. It's good to see you. Thank you very much. We'll talk soon. Thanks for watching.
So, folks, that segment was called the Idaho case, and it was the pursuit of the perfect murder. That's what we're hearing a lot from writers and from behavioral analysts of, oh, is this guy Koberger a mastermind? And whether they believe it or not, they put it out there on paper and behavioral analysts and authors for a book like this, they start talking. And James Patterson, of course, his whole dissertation there was, what are the questions that people want to know? What are the questions that the people need answered? And for that, that's why these books will be so popular. And that's why I believe they're jumping all over this. And two authors, no less, jumping on writing a book during, not post, during this case, before this case even goes to trial. And we've spoken about the potentiality that this case could foreseeably not go to trial till 2024. So we know that the next court date is October 2nd. Does anyone really believe that the trial is going to start on October 2nd? I would be quite surprised. It is a possibility it could, but it's improbable, I think. And again, what exacerbates this situation, of course, is the death penalty. which makes this case so much more complicated, because the potentiality that they will go for the death penalty is high, since this is a quadruple for young people. Again, I hate to refer to them as quadruple of the Idaho murders, because they are human beings. They are people: Ethan Chapin, Zaina Knodel, Madison Mogan, and Kaylee Gonsalves. It's about four young people at the time of the murders, with 20 and 21 years old, two 20-year-olds and two 21-year-olds. So it's an outrageous thing, and so many people have weighed in on this. Some experts in different fields, some people that are not experts, and they weigh in on things they have no right to even talk about. You know, you see all these talking heads on TV, and they have a certain expertise, and they go way out of their lane, and they start talking about everything. I guess that's the nature of television. Now, the second author is his name is Howard Bloom, and he was on Katie Kelly's podcast a few weeks ago. And he's highly opinionated he's an excellent writer. I'll give him that. He's an outstanding writer. I would imagine you don't get nominated for two Pulitzers unless you're an outstanding writer. He was nominated. He never won. And his name is Howard Bloom. So let me play a little bit of this, and we'll sort of dissect this a little bit.
Questions about the knife sheath and where it was sent to be tested. My next guest has new information on that. Joining us now is journalist and best-selling author Howard Bloom, who has worked for the New York Times and Vanity Fair. He is currently writing a book about Brian Koberger and covering the case for Air Mail News. Thank you so much for coming on, Howard. I'm a big fan of your recent articles on the case. Appreciate you taking the time tonight. I want to talk about the testing of this knife sheath and what you have learned about it.
Well, as you pointed out earlier, the police were all along moving forward, even though we and the media, the public, didn't know what was happening. And they were focusing on Brian Koberger, but they couldn't completely make the case so they could issue an arrest warrant. What they did is they had the knife sheath, and they had on the button of the knife sheath, they had touch DNA, and they had no way to tie that to Koberger. And the Idaho lab came up with this idea of using a separate lab in Texas. This lab had specialized in proprietary devices that made what is called kinship DNA. You could figure out a relative of the DNA that you already
have. It's actually called familial DNA. It's the first time I heard it used as kinship. It's been referred to as familial DNA. And that's where a lab like this, Lab Othram, they build family trees through DNA. Even the smallest amount of DNA, it's incredible. The science is going to totally revolutionize law enforcement, and it's called investigative genetic genealogy. And in no way am I an expert on this, but I was interested in this, and I think the expert across the country is a woman named Cece Moore. And they've been making identifications. Well, the recent rape case in Boston of that attorney who's just been arrested, that was made through investigative genetic genealogy. So what that would mean, I think, in the future, the FBI, which runs a database called CODIS, Combined DNA Index System, that potentially, and again, I'm not an expert on this, this new investigative genetic genealogy could potentially make the CODIS database obsolete at some point. And that came from the mouth of one of these famous genetic genealogists. And that is a real potentiality.
Had. And this lab was set up to investigate unsolved murders. It was backed by some Silicon Valley venture capitalists. It was a never before used in an in a present case, just at, only in cold cases.
So let me just interrupt you. Sorry to interrupt you, but you're saying this lab that they sent the knife sheath to has never been used before except in cold cases?
Yes, this was the first time they were willing to take a chance. They wanted desperately to make an arrest. They wanted.
You know, I this is where I had a problem with him, and we did a whole show on Howard Bloom. Of course you want to make an arrest, but you make an arrest by the rules, by going by the Bill of Rights, the Constitution of the United States, the law of arrest, and you play by the rules. I'm sure no one in the Moscow police, the FBI, or the Idaho State Police was looking to do something nefarious. I just don't like the way he says it. They were desperate. Yeah, they want to make an arrest. Four young people were slaughtered in their house off of University of Idaho campus. So I just don't like the way he says that. And then he has some other information that I find a little, you know, for someone criticizing it that's never done this type of work, and he speaks with great expertise when he doesn't have any expertise in this field.
Desperately to tie the suspect to this knife sheath. So meanwhile, in Pennsylvania, they gathered, they had that midnight garbage run.
Right.
All right, folks, what he's referring to, and again, I don't like the way he refers to that as the midnight garbage run. There is a way, and I spoke about it all the time because we always joke about the word surreptitiously, a way to surreptitiously collect someone's DNA. And in this case, they went through the garbage in the Koberger's home, and they were able to compare some item to the DNA in a knife sheath, and lo and behold, it came back to Brian Koberger's father, which anyway was a 99.98% chance that he matched that DNA also. So this is done all the time. But now, of course, what would the police do after that? They would get Brian Koberger's DNA and match his DNA with this DNA from the knife sheath.
Picked up garbage that was the father's DNA. They could then send that to the lab, tie it to the knife sheath, and they could make this kinship. And now they could say within, you know, 0.99.9% positive.
Right. I just want to zero in, Howard, on this Texas lab, because this is new information that you've reported that I didn't know until you reported it. When you say never before done technology that they're using, you know, that it's only been used on cold cases, I mean, couldn't this be an issue for the prosecution? This seems like something the defense could really zero in on. Why did the knife sheath get sent to this lab that has never done this kind of work?
I don't
before.
Think so. I actually think it will reinforce the prosecution's case.
You know, that this is what I don't understand about him. He's saying, oh, they never before. So what is different between testing the DNA from a cold case as compared to testing the DNA on a current case? What's the difference? It's the same science. So why is he trying to throw off the investigation and create doubt? And then when he's called on it, he totally changes up. Oh, no, this is fantastic. I don't get it. I don't get it. And again, the way this just, as you can see, I get a little annoyed at things like this. The most important thing is the way the evidence is collected. The way the evidence is collected and the how many people touch the evidence. You want the chain of custody. That's the most important thing. You want the chain of custody to be very short. But that's the most important thing. How was the evidence collected? And was the chain of custody, was the integrity kept intact? And that's what the most important thing is.
This lab is very respectable. Their cases, their evidence has been, the methodology has been held up in court time after time. And I think this reinforces the prosecution's case. I don't think it will be, it's not a positive for Koberger.
Let me ask you, because we did a story at the Idaho Crime Lab, looked very advanced. It was our understanding at the time that they were the ones doing all of the testing. Why would they need to send it to Texas?
They did not have the DNA that could prove kinship, relationship. And only this lab in Texas had this proprietary mechanism to do this. In fact, way before the Koberger, the case, the state of Idaho had made signed a contract with this lab in case something came up in a cold case to use this lab's facilities. And now they came up with the idea. I don't know whose idea it was in Idaho, but let's send it to this lab to get what we needed. Therefore, they had the garbage run in Pennsylvania, where the state police in Pennsylvania were able to get DNA from Koberger's father. They were able to tie that to the lab.
You know, folks, another aside here, one of the things that you can collect someone's garbage without a search warrant, because people, one of the things about getting a search warrant is that the person has to have an expectation of privacy to the property. In this instance, it was garbage. However, they could potentially argue that if the garbage pails were on the property of the Kohlbergers and not out front, where it would have been clear that it was left to be collected, then it potentially could be a problem. So they would most likely have obtained a search warrant, even for this garbage. And we, or another way to obtain the DNA of a suspect is to follow that person around, see if they smoke a cigarette, see if they drink out of a cup, and collect that cup. And again, the chain of custody of the evidence is very important. And of course, DNA evidence must be put in a paper bag, not a plastic bag, because a plastic bag can degrade the evidence. Just throwing some knowledge and some facts in there.
Lab into the knife sheath, and that's how they solved their best belief that Koberger is a suspect.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, listen, Howard, we appreciate you coming on. You're the one who broke this information. We didn't even know that Texas was involved. So thank you for coming on tonight and explaining what you learned.
Appreciate talking to you. And I've loved your reporting, too, on the case.
Oh, thanks so much. I appreciate that. We'll be in touch.
Thank you for watching.
So interesting. But again, there's the second person that's writing a book on this case. So what does that do when we get back to the whole overall point of, does it prejudice the jury pool? And the answer to that, of course, is yeah. Yeah, it does prejudice the jury pool, because all of this information out there is rather crazy, you know? And they spoke about Brian Koberger, and everyone is reading his body language. You see him walking there, and, you know, it's hard when you see someone that stares ahead like that. He seems rather rigid in his body language, that you would think someone that is in the field of body language analysis, that they wouldn't do that. But I think the point is that it's not helping the overall case that they're out there reading his body language, creating a behavioral analysis profile. All of that, believe it or not, I mean, that's going to all come up in the case when it does go to trial. The defense is going to have behavioral analysts. The prosecution is going to have behavioral analysts. And the defense and the prosecution's analysts are going to totally disagree with each other, which happens all the time. The defense gets the best behavioral analyst that money can buy, and so does the prosecution, and they go head to head. Folks, this is Police Off the Cuff, Real Crime Stories. If you like real crime, true crime from a police perspective, then you're in the right place. And if you're not subscribed to us, go on our YouTube, hit that subscribe button, give us a thumbs up, and ring that bell. And folks, if you want to support us financially, we have a Patreon with three different levels, and we also have a YouTube channel members with five different levels. And you see the folks in the green font in the chat. They're our friends, our fans, our subscribers. And without them, we could not survive in this podcasting world. Today would have been the 22nd birthday of Kaylee Gonsalves. And you can imagine how her parents and her siblings feel that it's her 22nd birthday, yet she's not around for it. And, you know, every day these family members live with this. There's no, I don't know if there'll ever be closure. We use that word closure. Maybe we overuse it. And I just want to play a little bit of Steve Gonsalves on the screen here.
Thank you both for doing this tonight on the eve of what I can only imagine will be an extraordinarily difficult day. Are you guys doing okay?
As good as you can.
Yep. We're hanging in there right now.
As you plan for this, listen, it's pretty big what you've decided to do. It's very selfless because, as I mentioned, some people would just fall away. But instead, you want everybody to be the beneficiary of Kaylee's life. Who came up with the idea?
Actually, it was the Laramie family who started it with Maddie Mayday. And we had been, you know, the girls are exactly 2 weeks apart, both born on Fridays. Maddie Mayday went by so good. And we were just like brainstorming like what we could do for Kaylee. And we got a hold of Karen and we asked Karen if she mind if we kind of piggybacked off of that idea. So that's what we did. And that's where the idea came from. And we just kind of ran with it with our own little, just a little bit of a spin on it. We did the do what you love, do something that you love, pay it forward type thing.
Yeah, I love some of these suggestions. I'm just going to read a couple of them that I grabbed off the poster. Go to lunch with a friend or a family member, plan a vacation or a holiday, cook a new meal, maybe grab a mimosa and an appetizer, try going on a brand new hike, wake up early for the sunrise, FaceTime with some friends or family, and pay it forward in some way. I mean, these are all just fantastic suggestions. We should do one of them every day. What are you guys going to do specifically tomorrow with your kids?
Well, tomorrow we're really going to concentrate on pushing that Kaylee J Day out to our community. We're paying it forward to several local coffee shops and restaurants with money to start. We've already kind of been running around town, all of us, posting flyers and asking them if they would participate in a pay it forward type program. So that's what we're doing. There are some balloon releases that will be happening as well. And then our family just plans on having just a small dinner with family together tomorrow evening and plan on actually doing a bigger party with family a little later on in the month when Olivia gets up here, because she's still down in California and she has to be here as well. So,
yeah, it wouldn't be complete without Olivia and her new baby as well, with lots of reasons to celebrate the grandchildren. Steve, how are the rest of the kids doing? How are Kaylee's siblings pulling through, especially at this time tomorrow when it's going to be tough, even for you, grown adults?
The truth is it's probably even harder for them. Emotionally, they are super sensitive. It's their sister. They had a relationship with them that lasted, you know, when we went to bed, they watched movies for hours. These girls and their brother were super close. They watched movies, they scared each other. They were just a classical American family. And
they're hurting.
It's hurting, you know. You can't fake this. You can try to make something positive out of it. You can do your best effort, but we're still struggling. You know, that's just the reality of it.
And still there's, you know, litigation. There's still business to be done. Even on Friday, there's gag order hearings. Do you share any of the information, progress, any of the developments with the kids, or do they really stay out of any of the news?
The older two, Stephen and Olivia, we definitely do. And they're, you know, they're adults. They do their own watching and investigating, you know, and whatnot. They're two younger. We try to, you know, our youngest is 10th grade. We try to keep her out of it, keep them out of it as much as possible. But if they ask questions, we definitely, you know, answer them. you know,
you can't hide anything with the internet.
We don't lie to them or sugarcoat anything. You know, and they do come to us with questions, and you know, we will answer those questions the best that we can.
How is your, you mentioned your son, Stephen Jr., how is he doing just in terms of his University of Idaho career? I know that was just, he'd be shell-shocked, and I think he was doing it from home for a while. Does he plan to go back to campus, finish at home? What are sort of the future plans there?
Stephen actually graduated as well. So he graduated, yes.
He graduated with his sister, but he gave up that graduation for his sister. He didn't. Yes. That's kind of how we try to raise our children, not to be self-centered and to like sacrifice their lives and try to like help other people and find value in that. And that's, as a father, that's what I felt like if I could have more children and give them a good life, then I was providing, I got a lot of comfort and enjoyment out of that. So Stephen's built out of the same cloth as I am. And he was like, you know what, this is my sister's day and I don't even need to have it today.
Yeah.
But we do need to, like, we need to get his diploma, put it up in a
celebrate him.
Yeah, yeah. We do.
He understands that we will be able to do that. He just understands that right now we just have a focus, unfortunately, elsewhere. But Stephen will have his day that we celebrate his accomplishments as well. And, you know, he knows that we're proud of him as well.
Yeah.
You know, folks, these people are amazing. You know, I think of what they've been through. And what is amazing to me when you talk about the human spirit and the fact that they are choosing to try and remain positive when, you know, the most horrific thing has happened, and they still are trying to remain positive. That's just incredible. It's an incredible thing. And, you know, earlier in the week, they had Ethan Chapin's mom on, and she was just also an incredible woman, and really chose to look at the positive of this rather than to dwell on the negative. And in fact, she even said that she won't be going to the trial because she doesn't think that is a positive thing for her to do. That would help her. And you got to realize, Ethan Chapin's mom has two siblings. He was a triplet, Ethan Chapin. And it's just horrific. But it's really, when you see the spirit of these people, it's just incredible that they're able to go on every day. And you could see how much Steve Gonsalves and his wife, I forget her first name, how much they're hurting. I mean, it's just incredible to watch it and to see them persevere through all of this pain. It's just an incredible thing to watch.
That kid has touched more lives. We say in our family, if we touch as many lives as he did in his 20 years, this world would be a better place.
Ethan was a triplet. His two siblings still attend the university. This May, graduation ceremonies were bittersweet as the school awarded Ethan a posthumous certificate. And now, Stacy Chapin has written a children's book about Ethan called The Boy Who Wore Blue. A portion of the profits will also go to the foundation, Ethan's Smile. And Stacy Chapin joins us now. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
It's hard to watch those images of your beloved boy. How are you doing?
It's hard.
Yeah, it is.
It's good, though. I mean, all things considered, we're doing very well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was a triplet. He has a brother and sister. Yes. How are they doing?
Jim and I couldn't be more proud of them, to be honest with you. They went back to school. They had a wonderful, they finished successfully this semester. And now they're back at work in a place that they love. And we've called summer home for a long time. So they're in a safe, great environment. And they're doing amazing. I'm so proud of them. I
It's amazing.
I think people are about to find out what an extraordinary family you have, Stacey, and what an extraordinary boy Ethan was. You've written this book. It's called The Boy Who Wore Blue. Tell me about writing it and what made you decide to write this story?
It started with my best friend sent me a news release that was that an author had been given the rights to the story to tell of these kids. And I, you know, as a mom, you're like, well, how does somebody write a story about people that they don't know, right?
And
about my kid. Yeah, I'm the one who's raised him, Gemini. And it just sparked something in me. And the only thing I can explain to people how the book came about is I think it's like a country artist who goes through a breakup and writes their greatest hit. It literally just came to me in the middle of the night.
It's Ethan's song.
It's everything. Yeah, it's the best I can do for him.
I love The Boy Who Wore Blue. You had triplets, and you learn in the book that when they were little, they used to each wear a color.
They did.
And that's how you told them apart when they were babies. And he was the one who wore blue.
He was the blue.
He was a very special young man. Everybody says it. Tell me about him.
Yeah. He was that way from the very beginning, to be honest. He was born happy. He was just magnanimous, kind of. I don't know really how to explain it. What we find more interesting is how many lives he touched that we didn't even know existed. It's incredible. I mean, I tell people if I touch as many lives in my lifetime as he did in 20 years, he just swarmed every room. He had a wonderful smile.
You hear in those stories now, people are calling you and saying, I remember when Ethan did this or that.
Yes, or strangers.
Yeah.
The strangers have been amazing who have come up to us. And it always started the same way. You know, you don't know me, but I have this story to tell you. Yeah.
What does that do for you? Is it comforting? Is it hard to kind of share your grief with this high profile story and it's so public?
We learned our family has always tried to help everybody. And we came upon the Sigma Chi boys the morning after. And in that moment, we realized that not only, you know, that it wasn't just, I mean, our family healed one way, but everybody needed to heal from this. And we saw it in an instant, kind of seeing all of his friends. And it's just gone from there. It's literally, we've been reached by people across the world. And we can see that everybody needs to heal from it. And it feels good.
You have extraordinary strength. Yeah. You and your husband seem to have this resolve. You say if people want to talk to you about it, it's okay to talk about.
Yes.
It's not the elephant in the room.
Yes.
You want to talk about Ethan.
Yes.
Where does that come from, that strength, when you're dealing with the unimaginable?
We just decided that, it has its moments, of course, right? But we get up every morning and we just decided that the best thing we can do is put our best foot forward, mostly for Maisie and Hunter. They deserve it. I mean, they didn't deserve this. And so they deserve still the best life that we can give them. And that is really our strength. It drives us. We literally get up and, you know, have coffee and then say, all right, we're going to go forward.
I was so struck by something you wrote. It was on social media earlier this year. You said, we spend no time being angry. That would be energy not well spent.
Yep.
And it still wouldn't change the outcome.
Yep.
We have to look at.
It's every time I watch this, it's these are definitely amazing people that the darkness of great tragedy, they can see light. And it's an amazing thing. And, you know, if you notice, if I can be so out there to say this, but if you notice people that are successful in life and happy people, usually they're very positive, you know. And when they do find a negative in some way, and I know I said this the other night, so I don't want to be redundant, but they'll turn a negative into a positive. And that's what this lady, Stacey Chapin, is doing. She has chosen to find a positive out of something that is so, so horrific, so negative. But it's an amazing thing, and it's an amazing talent, and it's an amazing thing to have in your life, and it's an amazing to be around people like that, that find the positive in tragedy and try to go about their life and not give up. It's really heartwarming. It's really, really quite amazing. And people like that are, you know, I think there's probably, if you believe in God and live a life hereafter, I think there's a place in heaven for someone like her, you know, really amazing. Folks, if you're looking for a great attorney in the New York metropolitan area, then Joe Murray is your man. Joe's a retired NYPD police officer and a fantastic defense attorney. You can reach Joe at 718-514-385. That's his cell phone. Or you can email him at joe@jmurray-law.com. He has a website, jmurray-law.com. And Joe, besides being a fantastic defense attorney, is also a huge supporter of the Police Off the Cuff podcast. And we really appreciate everything that he's done for us. You know, earlier on in the week, I played this this video of this prosecutor from California. And, you know, some people took great umbrage at it, but I respect this man because he's got credentials. He was a prosecutor for 17 years. And he's being interviewed on News Nation. And he says that the evidence against Brian Koberger is overwhelming. And I took heat from that because people don't want to hear that. But I want to play it again just to see what someone that does have the credentials and the background to make a statement like this, see what he says here.
Want the death penalty. These crimes were heinous. But yeah, they don't blame that. I don't blame them. But how does a prosecutor make this decision?
So a prosecutor under these circumstances will weigh the aggravating versus mitigating circumstances. It's essentially the same job that a jury will be asked to do. And this case is so overwhelmingly awful, for lack of a better term. I think there's going to be a lot of pressure within the DA's office to actually seek the death penalty on that.
And the evidence seems to be very strong. I mean, it's not circumstantial. There's hard, there's DNA evidence, there's cell phone evidence, there's... And there's a lot of evidence here.
The evidence against Brian Koberger is overwhelming, and that actually is a factor in that decision. Essentially, when people weigh the death penalty, elected DAs, they look for two things. They look for overwhelming evidence, absolutely no doubt of guilt, because the jury will be allowed to consider that in the penalty phase. And remember, this is a bifurcated system. So first there's the guilt trial, and mm-hmm. then there's the penalty trial. They are allowed to consider what's called lingering doubt. So if you have a case where there's some wiggle room or a juror might not be sure, they're allowed to consider that in imposing the death penalty. The second thing that every elected DA will consider in making a decision like this is the shocking nature of the crimes. Mm-hmm. The vast majority of cases that are eligible for the death penalty in the United States, the elected DAs don't actually seek it. In Orange County, we sought it in less than 4%. So it is...
Wow, why so seldom?
Well, for one thing, you want to be absolutely sure as a prosecutor because you have to take the death penalty very seriously, even in a state like California where it's essentially symbolic. It's a big deal to do it. Mm-hmm. It's also a lot more work and it takes a lot longer. And then it faces much harsher appellate scrutiny once the conviction and the sentence is imposed.
It also affects how you pick a jury.
It absolutely does. Now, what's interesting about this is that you're entitled to what's called a death qualified jury. Mm-hmm. So they'll bring in the veneer or the jurors for the trial, and they'll all fill out questionnaires, and they will be asked about their views on the death penalty. And if they cannot follow Idaho law, which allows for the death penalty, they will be excluded for what's known as cause. So they won't actually be in the jury panel, or they shouldn't be.
So you've been in this position before as a prosecutor, a homicide prosecutor. What do you think he's going to do?
I think this one is pretty clear. My guess is he's seeking the death penalty. Now, behind the scenes, what's happening is he's probably meeting with the defense and saying, show me what you got to try to talk me out of it. In California, we call that a livesy hearing. In Idaho, I don't know what they call it, but I'm sure they're going through that process right now.
Thank you for watching. Go to NewsNationNow.com.
So, folks, that's our show for this evening. We covered a lot of different ground. I hope I didn't confuse you by taking you on a journey all over the place. But the, you know, starting out with the gag order and talking about how that will affect the jury pool, how that will affect whether or not Brian Koberger gets a fair trial. And then, of course, segueing to two authors writing a book on this case before it even goes to trial. So we can understand what the prosecutor is up against in this case. What, you know, how is he, you know, one of the things that could happen, I don't know if it will happen, they could request a change of venue to a different location so they could get a jury that can be fair and impartial. I'm not saying it's going to happen, but that is a possibility. Schmitty, thank you for the $5 super sticker. Sergeant Bill's double-headed day, dipped in damn good butter. Thank you for considering us worthy of your work then and now. Superb. Schmitty, thank you so much. It's very much appreciated. I just hope that in tonight's show, we segued between the different aspects of this case, and I didn't confuse you guys going from, you know, the scientific to the two authors writing a book, the evidence, and then, of course, going to the feelings of the families in regards to what's going on with this case. Sometimes it's a little bit much, and it's a tough thing to take in. Folks, I just want you to all know that at 9 o'clock this evening, Duty Run is going on with Melanie Little. And if you guys are fans of Duty Runs, even if you're not, tune in at 9 o'clock to Duty Run. He's going to be on with Melanie Little. I want to thank everyone for tuning in tonight. Have a great rest of your night, and God bless from Police Off the Cuff Real Crime Stories. One episode, just ain't enough.